joins us right now. John, I appreciate the time. Thanks for coming on with us this morning.
Well, good morning, Jim. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's the 50th anniversary of the 1973 baseball season, and there's a little bit of a connection to, of course, this upcoming baseball season with the pitch clock, banning the shift, a lot of the significant rule changes that are happening in Major League Baseball, because back in 1973, we saw the DH come into play in the American League. And it was such a historic season where you saw the passing of the torch, so to speak, of the ball players of the 50s and 60s, like Willie Mays playing in the World Series for the Mets against Reggie Jackson for the Oakland A's, the emergence of the modern athlete, brash, opinionated, and those kind of things, Hank Aaron and his pursuit of Babe Ruth's home run record. There's just so many things that were going on in that impactful 1973 baseball season.
Right. It was really a watershed year, and both in the country and in the baseball, which as the national pastime back then reflected a lot of stuff that was going on in the country. You know, Nixon was there were the Watergate hearings going on, and there was Marlon Brando refused his Academy Award for The Godfather in solidarity with the American Indian Movement that had taken over Wounded Knee. Gas was scarce because of an oil crisis. And so there was a lot of turmoil in society and a change afoot, and that also was happening in baseball, as you mentioned, those events. And the other one was George Steinbrenner bought the Yankees and tried to buy back their faded glory. And so the season was, I think, you know, there's baseball before 1973 and baseball after 1973. And as you mentioned, the changes in baseball this year with the rules changes have people, you know, all up in arms about change. And certainly the DH rule was the biggest rule change that came along and impacted the game permanently.
Joining us this morning, the author of The Greatest Summer in Baseball History, How the 73 Season Changed Us Forever, John Rosengren, joins us on the Team Sports Network. Let's focus on, for just a moment, John, on Willie Mays and Reggie Jackson, because you had Willie Mays well past his prime, playing with the Mets in the World Series, was passed over a couple of different times by Yogi Berra for pinch hit opportunities in the World Series, and you had Reggie Jackson playing for the Oakland A's, which was a star-studded lineup with Sal Bando and Raleigh Fingers, I mean, and Vida Blue. I mean, it was just a list of who's who that played for the Oakland A's on that team. But you had a player in Reggie Jackson who was at the beginning of the Boomer era, who was brash, not afraid to speak his mind, and you had Willie Mays, who preferred to make his point with his play on the field. Not that Willie couldn't be opinionated and certainly was a leader when he was at the Giants, particularly when it came to some of the labor strife and things like that. But it was the transition in 73 of the player of the past who let his play speak for him to a guy that definitely was going to tell you what he was going to do, even though at times Reggie Jackson sometimes didn't deliver on some of the vocal promises that he made.
Right. That 1973 World Series showcased the changing of the guard of the superstars. And, I mean, it was just such an amazing series. Went seven games. The Mets were this incredible team that had been in last place on August 30th and made an incredible run at the end of the year with guys like Tom Seaver and Tug McGraw. Ended up beating the Reds in the division playoffs. Back then, there was just the one playoff five-game series, best of five playoff before the World Series. Willie Mays actually had the game-winning hit in Game 5 of that series. And then the A's were this, you know, irascible bunch of guys who were fighting among themselves but united in their common enmity against the owner, Charlie O'Finley, who just could not stop meddling and messing with the team, to the point where in the middle of the World Series, Dick Williams said, "Enough, I quit." He made it through the end of the World Series, but he said, "No more, I can't handle this." And then you had Willie Mays, the best player in baseball in the 50s and 60s, and, you know, a humble guy with all the tools who could beat you in so many different ways. And he was on his last legs, and Reggie Jackson was this up-and-coming superstar. He had played in his first World Series with, as you mentioned, the mouth of, you know, not afraid to speak out, speak his mind. He was called by the sports writer the most valuable quote. But he was a new brand of athlete, one who would thump his chest and pump his fists after a home run and say, look at me. And, you know, it's quite a contrast from what we'd seen in Willie Mays, but it represented, again, the times. You know, in 1973, he reflected an attitude in society, and it caught on. You know, look what we have now. Guys, you know, doing the bat flip and all the celebrating that goes on. So Reggie Jackson was the pioneer in that.
John Rosengren joining us today. He's written the book, The Greatest Summer in Baseball History, How the 73 Season Changed Us Forever. And part of that, I mean, that 73 season was also the chase for the home run title, the all-time home run record held by Babe Ruth, but pursued by Hank Aaron, and the death threats, the racial taunts, the things that Hank Aaron had to endure. And I saw a piece the other night on Dusty Baker, who of course managed the Astros to the World Series this past season, where Dusty was on deck when Hank Aaron hit the home run that set the record. And basically, Hank Aaron just turned to Dusty and said, I'm going to get this over with now. And then goes out and hits, of course, the legendary home run to set the record. But Hank Aaron, take us through that, John, because he endured a lot during that chase for Babe Ruth's record.
Right. And again, it's important to put that in the context of the times. I mean, this is 1973. We're just past the Jim Crow era. You know, the civil rights movement has been in full force now for about a decade. And yet the bigots are still strong and out there. All in the Family was the top TV show, and Archie Bunker, you know, America's favorite bigot. And so Aaron had the challenge of not just performing at the plate like any player, but he's trying to beat this record of Babe Ruth, who's the most revered figure in sports at that point, and he's the legendary mark of 714 home runs. And so there's the pressure just to perform and you know, hit home runs. But then he's getting more mail than anybody else in the country. And just a ton of mail is pouring in. And about a third of that is hate mail. You know, a lot of people are supporting him, but a third of that was people saying, you know, just these ugly racial epithets and, you know, you have no place doing this. And I think people felt threatened by a black man eclipsing a white hero. And it was Reggie Jackson called a form of white supremacy of people rooting against Aaron. And then not only that, there were death threats on Aaron and his children and his wife. And, you know, someone called his parents and said, we're going to kill your son. And they listed specific dates of series. You know, he was in places where he was playing. And so he lived under incredible stress and pressure that season. And he spoke out about it. And he spoke out, you know, about the wrongness of it, the injustice of it. At the same time, he bore it with a grace and dignity that was admirable, and I think made him a hero, you know, for all time, not just that year.
No doubt about it. Hank Aaron, one of the classiest individuals in sports, period, not just baseball. We're talking with John Rosengren. He has written the book, The Greatest Summer in Baseball History, How the 73 Season Changed Us Forever. And part of that was the start of the rebirth of the Yankees. Because the Yankees, of course, dominant baseball team, tremendous history, 40s, 50s, into the 60s with Maris and Mantle and Ruth and Gehrig. I mean, just the Whitey Ford. I mean, the list goes on and on. Yogi. But the Yankees in the early 70s were a shadow of their former selves. They were a struggling ball club, both on the field and financially. They were owned by CBS Broadcasting. And George Steinbrenner, who was a Cleveland, Ohio shipping magnate, would build ships, and Steinbrenner, who tried always to reach the success level of his father, which was tough for George Steinbrenner to do, was trying to find that way to be as successful as his father. And he felt like after he had turned the family business around in the shipping industry and in the shipbuilding field, that he was going to go out and buy the Yankees. And there was one point, though, there was a group that was going to buy the Yankees from CBS, and Willie Mays was going to be the manager. Take us through that story a little bit, how Steinbrenner ends up with the Yankees at a bargain basement price, by the way, particularly, you know, in what they're worth now, and how Willie Mays almost ended up being the Yankee manager.
Yeah, isn't that crazy to think, what if Willie Mays had managed the New York Yankees? And that was because Horace Stoneham, the owner of the Giants, had been interested in buying the team, but got wasn't able to do so. And then Stoneham had said, you know, if I buy the team, I'll have Willie Mays manage him. But it was George Steinmetz, as you mentioned, the Cleveland shipbuilder, trying to win his father's approval, desperate for his father's approval, who came in with a team or with a group of guys and bought him for $10 million from CBS, who had purchased the team in '64 for $13.2 million. So, and actually, the final purchase price was 8.7 after CBS bought back a couple of parking garages. So, right, truly a bargain basement price, right? Can you imagine him buying a franchise, let alone the Yankees, for 8.7 million? That's like, I wish, you know, I'd bought the Coke stock at 10 cents.
No kidding, or Apple back in the, you know, the early days. Exactly.
Right.
Wish we would have done that.
If only we'd had the right financial advisors at the time.
No kidding, John.
But so he comes in and, you know, he says, I'm going to stick to building chips, but he can't. And immediately he starts meddling. You know, in spring training, he gives the manager a list of players who need haircuts, and he signs seven guys who have held out, including Bobby Mercer, to a $100,000 contract, which sounds like nothing today, but it actually, there were only 23 guys making $100,000 at the time. Top salary is $225,000 a year, which is Dick Allen. But it was... immediately starts meddling with that and throwing big money into the team to, you know, help buy back their faded glory. And they had fallen on hard times. They, 72, they'd lost 76 games and $1 million. And, you know, George did turn it around in a rather bombastic way and alienating people along the way and stepping on toes and edging people out. But the Yankees did return to their former glory with the infusion of big money, which, again, changed the game forever.
Absolutely. John Rosengren with us today. The greatest summer in baseball history, how the 73 season changed us forever. A couple other points, John, if you can, while we have time remaining here, from the book that you thought were key moments in that 73 season. I think we hit on a lot of the highlights with Hank Aaron's home run chase, the DH coming to play in the American League, likewise with Reggie Jackson and Willie Mays, but maybe another point or two that are takeaways from the book that really illustrated what a significant season 73 was for baseball and for the country.
Well, I think you can't underplay the importance of the DH, because that was the owners embarked on that as a 3-year experiment, and mostly to resuscitate the game. In 72, there had been a player strike, and fans were really upset about that. They weren't sympathetic to the players. In 73, the owners locked the players out during spring training because they were negotiating a new basic agreement. And so the game was really sort of in danger. Attendance had fallen, particularly in the American League. So they thought, Charlie Finley's idea, actually, a permanent pinch hitter. They thought this, you know, no one likes to see the pitcher bat, so they thought, have a designated hitter, you can create more offense, more interest in the game, and it worked. I mean, I tell the story through Orlando Cepeda, who had retired because his knees had gone bad after the 72 season, but the Red Sox hired him as the first guy hired to be specifically a designated hitter, and he had a great season and showcased the idea that this could save the game. And sure enough, across the league, there were more hits, more runs, more home runs. So, you know, more offense, more excitement, and most importantly, more fans. So it was such a success that at the end of the season, the owners voted to keep it for another, make it a permanent thing. And that really, I think, did impact the game and turn it around and, you know, affect strategy, et cetera.
John Rosengren with us. He has written the book, The Greatest Summer in Baseball History, How the 73 Season Changed Us Forever. And, of course, it's through Sourcebook. So, John, Amazon, the normal outlets, local bookstore, you can pick up your book there, correct?
Right, even at the local library. And if it's not there, ask for it, and they'll order it for you.
Please do. John Rosengren, The Greatest Summer in Baseball History, How the 73 Season Changed Us Forever. John, I really appreciate the time this morning. Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thanks for having me on, Jim. Good to talk to you.
Likewise. Take care. Love the book. And if you love baseball history, a lot of history, the 50th anniversary.